Shub, and I'm going to be talking about some ongoing work with Lisa Randall and Janos Shree at Harvard called Olympi Baryogenesis Miracle. And it's a model of dark matter where we incorporate baryogenesis into it, and baryogenesis happens because of dark matter annihilation. As an overview of my talk, first I'll give some motivation for why we might be interested in looking at this kind of scenario. We'll dominantly look at the wind miracle and the dark matter baryon ratio. Then I'll do a review of baryogenesis for those who maybe aren't as familiar with some of the details, using as an analogy the leptogenesis to the decay of right-handed neutrinos, which will serve as an analogy for our model. I'll then discuss Wimpy leptogenesis, which is the leptogenesis through dark matter annihilation, as a concrete example, and show how it satisfies the conditions of baryogenesis, and how we can anticipate how much of an asymmetry we should get through that. Finally, I'll discuss some more models, and then finally briefly talk about some constraints and prospects for detection. So to begin with, to date there's no conclusive evidence for what dark matter actually is. There are a number of interesting hints, but nothing certain yet. And so we're not going to be chasing any of the recent anomalies and dark matter detection experiments. Instead, we're going to focus on some astrophysical observations of dark matter that might give some insight into what dark matter is and what its interactions are. The first one is with the dark matter abundance. And that is the fact that if you take a new stable weak scale particle and compute its relic density, then you automatically get about the right dark matter relic density. So this is something that's called the Wimp miracle and indicates that there might be some connection between dark matter and the weak scale. The second is the ratio of the densities of dark matter and baryons, the energy densities, and the energy density of dark matter is about 5 times that of baryons. And once again, if there were no connections between these two sectors other than gravity, then you might anticipate that these things would be many, many orders of magnitude apart. And so this suggests that there may be some common origin for the two. Now, our models are motivated by both of these observations. So for the first, the Wimp miracle, we have our dark matter abundance established according to the Wimp miracle. So this is something that's just the usual symmetric dark matter whose relic abundance is determined by thermal freeze-out. However, the dark matter annihilation is going to generate a baryon asymmetry. And this is going to give some connection between the dark and visible sector abundances. And I do want to point out that there is another paper out there, or two papers, that look at connecting the Wimp miracle to baryogenesis in a very different way, and that's not involving dark matter, but that uses this coincidence in cross-section. So if you're interested, you should definitely check that out. So this is a review of what these observations are. I'll start with the Wimp miracle. So if we consider some stable, weakly interacting massive particle, it's in equilibrium and relativistic in the early universe. And the question is, what happens to it as the universe expands and cools? So when the temperature is larger than the Wimp mass, then all the fields are in equilibrium, and we have rapid scattering of dark matter fields into standard model fields and vice versa. And this keeps all of their number densities the same. However, as the temperature drops below the mass of dark matter, then this inverse scattering rate of standard model into dark matter gets suppressed because the standard model fields are no longer energetic enough to create dark matter. And so the Wimp density gets depleted and depleted. And eventually, the dark matter particles are no longer able to find one another to annihilate because there are so few of them. And so if we have some annihilation process that looks like this and do the calculation, we find that the relic abundance is inversely proportional to the annihilation cross-section. The more it interacts with something, the less of it that you expect to find around. And in particular, if you compute the Wimp relic density, it's exactly the same as the observed dark matter relic density if its annihilation cross-section is around a picobarn. And this is the cross-section that you get naturally out if you have weak-scale masses and order one couplings for your fields. So this suggests that maybe dark matter comes about through some annihilation process like this. However, in the Wimp miracle framework, the fact that omega dark matter is similar to omega baryon, their energy densities are the same, is just a coincidence. The reason is that the amount of baryonic matter that we have comes about through an entirely different mechanism, namely that there's a matter-antimatter asymmetry. All the antimatter annihilates at some point, and you're just left with some residual matter. So in the conventional Wimp picture, these two processes are completely independent, and any connection that there might be is just a coincidence. So some people say, well, the Wimp miracle itself is just a coincidence, so why don't we swap these, and instead of taking the Wimp miracle as important, take this correspondence as important instead. So what we'll do is ignore the Wimp miracle and instead focus on models that explain this particular relationship. What you end up with are models of what are known as asymmetric dark matter, where both dark matter and baryons come about because of some matter-antimatter asymmetry, and you can construct models that relate the asymmetries between these two sectors. And it's quite an old idea. It's been around at this point for over 25 years. But there's been a recent resurgence in interest in it, in model building in the last 2 years. And a lot of interesting stuff is going on with that. But it's worth pointing out that the phenomenology that you get is quite different. So for example, if dark matter is asymmetric, then we only have dark matter around now, not dark antimatter. And the upshot of that is that we don't expect to see signals in indirect detection experiments, because there's no more dark matter annihilation going on today. Similarly, the annihilation cross-section has to be different in order to efficiently deplete the symmetric component, and so on. So the phenomenology is distinct. And so we're interested in saying, can we get some of the features of symmetric dark matter in terms of its interactions and how it exists in the halo, while also establishing a connection between the dark matter and baryon abundances? So do we have to give up one to have the other? And so what I'm going to talk about in my talk is this a model that does give you what's similar to conventional WIMP dark matter in terms of its annihilation rates and everything, but that also generates a baryon asymmetry. And so this is nice for a few reasons. But first of all, it ties all dark matter and baryogenesis to the weak scale. So this means that this gives us a hope of giving some natural explanation for the masses and couplings that you see. Maybe it comes about through whatever new physics we expect to find at the weak scale. This is also nice from the perspective of baryogenesis, because a lot of baryogenesis models happen at very high temperatures. And so there are problems with Suzy reheat bounds, and you might not expect to see evidence of that at the moment if it's happening at a sufficiently high scale. So we expect to also get indirect detection signals, just like you get for conventional WIMP dark matter. And finally, it's interesting because it incorporates the idea of baryogenesis by annihilation, which has often been overlooked in the literature. And it's something that anytime you expect to have baryogenesis through the decay of something, you can also get baryogenesis through annihilation. And there are a few papers that have sort of proposed it and looked at it in a very cursory manner. But this is the first time that it's really been embedded in a model and where you're sort of getting something out of doing the annihilation. But I think that it's definitely worth exploring this class of models more, because when we talk about the range of baryogenesis, we're often neglecting this and, you know, the sort of the range of possible results we might get.
Can I ask you how that works? I mean, so is the annihilation into a state which not in equilibrium or which not in
equilibrium, but then so the out of equilibrium condition, I'll talk about it a little bit more, but it's basically satisfied by the fact that, so there are two different things that have to go on. The first is that as the universe cools below the mass of the dark matter particle, then there's net annihilation going on, so that breaks equilibrium because you have some net transfer from one to another. So that allows to generate an asymmetry, and then you need to make sure that the other interactions don't wipe out the asymmetry that you get. But it's sort of schematically, anytime you have baryogenesis of the decay of something, you can always stick some initial states on, you know, the other side, and then you get baryogenesis through annihilation. So it's basically the exact same process, but you can end up with some qualitatively different results. So we know from the WIMP miracle that the couplings do need to be order one, so it does raise this question of whether the departure from thermal equilibrium is enough to give you a sufficiently large asymmetry. And so we'll argue that for some parameters, you can get a large enough baryon asymmetry. I'll talk about what the masses have to be for that to work. Now we'll do a review of baryogenesis. So there are three conditions that are known as the Sakharov conditions. And these conditions allow you to generate an asymmetry and some charge. So first of all, you need to have violation of baryon number, or whatever your charge that you want to generate an asymmetry is. So this is obvious. If you don't violate the symmetry, you can't actually create an excess of one over the other. And then we need to have a violation of C and CP. And this allows us to favor either matter over antimatter or the reverse in generating asymmetry. And finally, we need a departure from thermal equilibrium. And this is just the statement that in equilibrium, forward and backward scattering rates are happening at equal speeds. And so if you create an excess of one particle over the other, then the process that wipes out that excess will go faster and eliminate it. So you need to make sure that there is some turn off of those equilibrium conditions. Now in the standard model, all three of the conditions are technically satisfied, but there are two major restrictions to generating a large baryon asymmetry. The first is that we don't have big enough CP violation. So CP violation in the standard model vanishes in, if there are only two generations. So you need to go through all three generations. So you're suppressed by many powers of Yukawa couplings. And second of all, the standard model Higgs phase transition is not strongly first order, and that's usually how you get a departure from thermal equilibrium. So you can generate an asymmetry, but it's far too small.
Can I ask you something about this point? Have people looked at how easy is it to satisfy those conditions in the Dutton models? Because in such a model, you can certainly get charged on a CP violation, but it's not clear do you get strong first order?
Not in just the most basic two Higgs doublet models. So electroweak baryogenesis does survive, but typically you need to color couple some light colored scalars to.
That's this idea of having a light stop around.
That's right. So you can think of the MSSM as some two Higgs doublet light model. So the parameter space is somewhat constrained, but in principle you can do it. And there are some papers that study this in fairly model-independent ways. They show what happens if you add a generic fermion and a generic scalar and say, okay, what do the parameters have to be to give you a first order phase transition?
And basically, you just need the triangle diagram to become strong.
Right? That's right.
And the three point diagram.
Yeah, basically. So in the vanilla standard model, we don't get enough CP violation, but there are other mechanisms that are proposed that are based on very simple extensions of the standard model, in particular ones that we expect to find new physics anyway. So the example that I'll use is electrogenesis and the decay of right-handed neutrinos. And the reason why this is nice is because it incorporates neutrino masses into it. So if we write down the standard Cs-all Lagrangian, which consists of the Yukawa coupling and a Majorana mass for the right-handed neutrinos, and we naturally generate light neutrino masses for the left-handed guys because it's suppressed by powers of this heavy Majorana mass. So this can explain why you have light neutrino masses, but you've also now added in a whole bunch of new ingredients that allow us to satisfy the Sakharov conditions. For example, we now violate lepton number explicitly. We're not relying on the sphalerons of the electroweak phase transition. So this Majorana mass violates lepton number, and that can then be transferred into baryon number at lower scales. You can have new CP phases also in these new Yukawa matrices, so relative phases between these two fields that can't be rotated away. Now, it's important that they be relative phases, and the way that this shows up is by considering the decay of, just the decay of one into a lepton. We consider only the tree level diagram when we take the matrix element squared of this guy, that any phases that appear are going to go away. Okay. So in order to have the CP phases show up physically in your amplitude, you need to consider interference between tree level and loop level effects. So basically, you'll end up with products of multiple couplings, and then take the imaginary part of all of them will show up. Okay. So this is important to determining how big the CP violation you're going to get. It's a loop effect, and it's going to be suppressed by four powers of the coupling. So if we look at the specific case of the decay of the lightest right-handed neutrino to the first generation of lepton, CP violation can give us a difference in the rate to decay to lepton versus anti-lepton. This allows us to generate an asymmetry. So if we look at one possible term in taking the matrix element squared, we're looking at the interference between the tree and loop guy. We see that this gives us a Y star between the two first generations. Then this gives us a product of three other couplings. Two are Ys and one is a Y star. And so their product is going to give us some non-zero phase. And this is why it's important that you have multiple generations of everything. Because if you only had one generation of neutrino, one generation of lepton, then you would have two Ys, two Y stars, and they would give you something real. So you wouldn't actually end up seeing the CP phase. So we can define this parameter epsilon, which is basically the fractional asymmetry produced per decay to L. So each time you decay, how much lepton number asymmetry are you getting? And this will be proportional to the imaginary part of the product of these four couplings. And it's going to be also proportional to the ratio of the masses between the first neutrino and the heavy neutrinos. So the point is that as you take the, you know, you have some mass spectrum for your neutrinos, and as you take them heavy, then you expect these loop effects to be suppressed by integrating out the heavy neutrino. So these points are going to be relevant when we do ours, because you want to make your efficiency of generating asymmetry as big as possible. But you're limited by this quartic power of couplings, and you're also limited by this mass suppression as you, you know, if you try to make the neutrinos hierarchical. Okay, so these are the first two points. We have explicit lepton number violation. We have a CP violation. So now how about departure from thermal equilibrium?
So you skip that step a little bit. When you move the symmetry from the lepton to the baryons, you do it with spallerons?
That's right.
So that part of the story does not change the properties at all?
It doesn't, no. Although that will turn to be relevant because so spallerons are only active above the electron phase transition. And so there is some timing at which the lepton asymmetry has to be generated. So if you create a lepton asymmetry below the electron phase transition, then the asymmetry is not going to be transferred into baryons. So it's relevant in terms of that. But because these things are very rapid in the symmetric phase, as long as you generate any asymmetry, it will be distributed into baryons. And the actual details of that don't really matter so much. OK, so this allows us to generate an asymmetry. We have CP violation. So the departure from thermal equilibrium comes in two parts. So the first is the fact that the universe is cooling. So if the universe cools down enough, then these particles are going to decay. And the standard model particles don't have enough energy to reform the heavy guys. So we have this net decay of the right-handed neutrino. So this generates the asymmetry. And then you have to think of the fact that since we have interactions that create an asymmetry, we also have interactions that destroy the asymmetry. So for example, we have scatterings where you have one lepton turns into no leptons, or we have a lepton goes into an anti-lepton, and so on. And so if you generate an asymmetry and these things are happening rapidly, then they tend to damp away any asymmetry that you've developed. So we don't just need the cooling of the universe, we also need these scatterings to turn off. Okay? And the way that this typically happens is that we say, okay, well, let's just hold off on having the right-handed neutrinos decay until after all of these processes have shut off. And since these processes typically shut off at temperatures around the mass scale of the right-handed neutrino, you see there are intermediate ends all over the place here. We need to have.
But the decay itself, I mean, the lifetime of the right-handed neutrino is also governed by the Hammer problem.
That's right.
So it's not so easy just to switch it off, right? Switch the decay off relative to the washout.
Yeah, so there's definitely a correlation between those two things. But if you make the. So in this particular case, if you make
the. I'm a little bit asking, what is the parameter? What are the parametrics that allows you to?
So when you make the Yukawa coupling small, then you do both of these things at the same time. You make the lifetime longer and you make the washout less pronounced. So typically, so you always have this parameter that you can dial that suppresses the washout and makes you go out of equilibrium more. So it works out nicely in this case. It's more challenging in the dark matter case because remember that dark matter couplings need to be order one in order to efficiently annihilate down to, you know, the amount that we observe now. So you can't make the coupling too small in that case. So you can't just dial down couplings. All right. So now we'll take the lessons that we've seen here and apply them to the case of dark matter annihilation. So this is wimpy leptogenesis. So we're going to create a lepton asymmetry through dark matter annihilation. And the satisfaction of the Sakharov conditions are going to be similar to before. So we can violate lepton number by having new couplings that explicitly violate standard model lepton number symmetry. We can have CP violation by having some relative phases in the new couplings that we're introducing. And the departure from thermal equilibrium is similarly going to occur in these two stages. So as the universe cools, the temperature drops below the dark matter mass, we're going to have net dark matter annihilation. This is going to lay the ground for creating an asymmetry from their annihilation.
So just to be very clear what we're going to do, leptogenesis achieves the asymmetry by decay.
That's right.
You're going to achieve it by putting couplings so that the scattering has asymmetry?
That's right. So if you like, we're doing something similar, except we're adding in some new initial state so that they annihilate to the intermediate.
That's
so
right. You're not using the spallerons to transfer lepton.
That's right. We're still using spallerons to transfer lepton.
Are you actually in danger then? I mean, cosmologically, that you would create a lepton asymmetry which would screw BBN, for example?
It's not going to screw BBN. I mean, you're in danger of not creating a big enough lepton because the spallerons could turn off while you're doing it. So that turns out to be the most significant model-independent constraint on this scenario, which is that dark matter freeze-out has to happen before the spallerons turn off.
So somehow the symmetry will stabilize the dark matter have some connection with the same, with the laptop. So your full server, your complete server.
So we don't necessarily have that. You could, in principle, have that. So we're going to take a bottom-up approach where we're basically just saying, what's the minimum number of fields and symmetries that you need in order to have a consistent framework? But you could conceivably have some connection between the symmetry that you're breaking here and the dark matter symmetry. But you don't necessarily need to have that. So I'll go into details when I talk about a specific model about how you can actually accomplish this. So we have, if we're trying to satisfy the out of equilibrium condition, we have net dark matter annihilation as you go down below the mass of the dark matter. And then we also need these washout processes, these scatterings that destroy lepton number, to go out of equilibrium while annihilation is still going on. So that you have some, you're producing some lepton number after these go out of equilibrium so that you get some non-zero value at the end. So how can we make this washout go out of equilibrium sufficiently early? We can't just do what we did last time. So in the case of the particle that's decaying, it has some lifetime that's roughly temperature independent. And so you can have the decay be out of equilibrium initially, but then as the universe expands more and the Hubble constant drops, the decay can come into equilibrium. For scatterings, this...
Actually, not entirely true, but it's temperature independent, right? Because you have Popov.
Pardon me?
It's not entirely true that the decay is temperature independent. Because if the decay to some extent has a high intensity, there's Popov blocking.
Yeah.
You ever gonna have degenerate?
You don't have. I don't think we have ever have densities high enough to worry about that. Pardon me.
I was just asking. Are you gonna have densities high enough to handle degenerate?
No, no. So we don't have to worry about that. So there is a time dilation factor that you have to worry about when they're relativistic. But apart from that, that's the only change to their lifetime in these thermal scenarios. But the scattering cross-sections are just, they're falling monotonically with temperature. And so in some sense, it's really hard to get them out of equilibrium and in equilibrium and out of equilibrium. So the way that we satisfy the out of equilibrium conditions for washout is that dark matter annihilations are always in equilibrium while this is happening. But if one of the fields that carries lepton number is heavy, right, then the washout cross-section is going to be suppressed because there aren't going to be as many of those around, you know, as you drop below the dark matter mass. So if you have some massive lepton number carrying field with a mass that's comparable to the dark matter mass, it's going to have a suppressed abundance at the time that this is all playing out. And the washout cross-section can actually go out of equilibrium and generate a sufficiently large asymmetry. So you can have a similar thing come out if the washout cross-section is much smaller than the annihilation cross-section. But it's really hard to arrange because you have similar couplings that appear in both of these scenarios. But we'll show explicitly how this works in a minute. So let's write down a model that can actually accomplish this, and hopefully that will resolve some of the outstanding questions. So we want dark matter to annihilate to leptons. So we'll start by stating this model-independent constraint that exactly comes from what we were just saying, that the lepton asymmetry is transferred to a baryon asymmetry through sphalerons. The sphalerons become ineffective after the electroweak phase transition, and so all of this has to happen before the electroweak phase transition. Otherwise, you don't get a big enough asymmetry. And because the phase transition temperature is the 50 to 100 GeV ballpark for a standard model Higgs, then you find that this restricts dark matter to be at the TeV scale. Now, this will be relaxed if you're directly creating baryons, but as long as we're doing leptogenesis, this constraint is going to hold. So the minimal setup that we need some dark matter particle. We're going to make it a singlet just to avoid direct detection constraints. We want dark matter to annihilate to a lepton. So for concreteness, we choose the lepton doublet, although you could choose something else. And the easiest way to break standard model lepton number is that you're only going to create one lepton every time you annihilate, so that you're, in a very sort of explicit way, breaking this lepton number. And we'll see in a moment the implications that this has to have. But if we write down what's the simplest effective operator that allows you to do that, well, we have two dark matter particles that annihilate into a lepton, plus something else. That something else is going to be prescribed by gauge invariance. So in this scenario, it's a doublet with hypercharge of a half, but it could, in principle, be something else. Okay. And from the low energy perspective, we're going to assume that this thing is vector-like so that it has a mass that is a free parameter in the theory. But it could get its mass through some kind of Higgs mechanism. Okay, so what does this tell us about the lepton asymmetry?
Let me just, this,
Yes.
So you have psi, which is basically fourth generation.
That's right.
Lepton, and you have some right-hand partners, others that you can marry off.
That's right.
Why then are you not allowed to write the other operators and companies that's to the right of that?
Right. So that's something that I'm going to get to just now. So you need to have some kind of a symmetry that sets apart this fourth generation lepton from something else. Because otherwise, so the concern is that every time you're creating an L, you're also creating one of these new guys. And so there is a preserved U1 symmetry under which these things are oppositely charged. Okay. So you can create a standard model lepton asymmetry, but you can't create some generalized asymmetry under, you know, if you add up the charges of both of these things. So the problem with these mixing terms that you're proposing, one of the problems, is that it could allow these psi fields to decay back into standard model leptons but have opposite charges, and then the asymmetry would just go away. So you need to make sure that doesn't happen.
You add a way to something.
That's right. Okay, so we don't get a generalized leptons.
So do we have a Hermitian conjugate of this?
Yes, that's right.
Then you through this annotation you will generate the lepton number.
That's right.
So is that the ninth lepton number will be zero? You have because
no,
so your x is it's like a Mariana particle.
So at this point, I haven't specified. It turns out that in order to prevent these kinds of operators, x will have to be a Dirac particle. So, but the Hermitian conjugate term just allows x's to annihilate into anti-leptons, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to be the difference between those rings that gives you the lepton asymmetry. So adding in the Hermitian conjugate doesn't.
So you also have this kind of loop effect.
That's right. So I'm just writing this down like this in order to see sort of what's the simplest possibility and then what do we need in our model in order to realize that. Right. So yes, we have this concern that we have this asymmetry, this negative lepton number asymmetry that could decay back into standard model leptons and wipe out the one that we see. And then the other concern is also that if this thing is stable, then we end up with too much of it at late time, because it has an asymmetry that's comparable to the lepton asymmetry. But the lepton on doublets is 90 GeV. And so you don't want it just sticking around until late times, because then you'll end up overclosing the universe. So there are two ways that you can resolve this. One way is to have two different sectors, one with this new particle in it and other things that it might be interacting with. And they only couple to leptons through this kind of an operator, such that you're creating equal and opposite symmetries and two asymmetries in two different sectors, but then those two things are decoupled. So this is similar to what you have in the case of Dirac leptogenesis, where if you're creating asymmetries in both left and right-handed neutrinos, the left-handed doublets are can convert to a baryon asymmetry through sphalerons, whereas the right-handed doublets don't talk to anything. The right-handed neutrinos don't talk to anything. So this is one possibility. So for example, you could have psi decaying into a Higgs plus some singlet, where this singlet is also charged under whatever it is that prevents the psi from decaying back into leptons. The other way that you could avoid this is by having this psi just decay through explicitly U1 violating couplings. So you just say, I'm going to violate a lepton number. I'm not even going to have any remotely preserved symmetry. So you could, for example, have a psi bar L E bar type coupling. And that coupling has to be small. It's restricted by neutrino masses. The fact that neutrino masses are small puts some constraint on those. But this could, in principle, work. But we're going to focus on the first setup where we have two different sectors. So how can we get that? Well, we have this kind of a setup. What we want are these two things that don't talk to each other except through this higher dimensional operator. We also want our dark matter to be stable. So we can bundle all of these things into one discrete symmetry where if we have a Z4 symmetry where the charge of x is I, the charge of psi is -1, and the charge of the standard model fields is +1, then we make dark matter stable, and we prevent this field from mixing in with standard model particles. And you could consider this as some discrete subgroup of the continuous symmetry that is there. But we're not going to talk necessarily about why you have this. We're just going to assume this setup. But because of this charge that ensures dark matter stability, it means that dark matter does have to be Dirac. Otherwise, you can't write down a mass term for it. So this ensures the survival of your lepton number asymmetry down to lower scales. Okay, so if we want to actually complete this model, the simplest completion is that just add in some new scalars. So we have some two dark matter interaction with the scalar, and then the interaction with the scalar and L psi. Integrating this out generates exactly the interaction we have. And this is fully consistent with the discrete symmetries that we've written down. So what do you get out of this? Well, we're going to get annihilation scatterings that are going to be two x's annihilating into this L and psi through an intermediate scalar. And this is going to be proportional to the square of the dark matter coupling to the scalar times the square of the lepton coupling to the scalar. And then we're also going to have these washout scatterings where L and psi go into their complex conjugates. And this is going to be proportional to this coupling to the fourth power.
Wait, you generate other operators right away, right? You generate operators that allow you to use psi and psi in the class transmission.
That's right.
Does not consider the values?
Well, so these things are above the bound. So, yes. So they're not dangerous. Right, because remember that the dark matter in this scenario also has to be quite heavy. So you're safely above any collider constraints. But that is nice because it allows you some way that you could maybe directly see this coupling if you had a lepton collider. Okay, so we have baryon number violation. The way that this is violated is that we have this lepton number violating coupling, and then the Sphalerons converted into a baryon asymmetry. The way we get CP violation is exactly the same way that we had before. So if these couplings have CP phases, we compute the interference of tree and loop diagrams. The diagrams look very similar to before. We have this tree diagram, the self-energy correction, and vertex correction. And if we have more than one generation of the scalar, then we can have relative phases, even just if we consider a single generation of lepton. So this generates CP violation exactly the same way as before. Okay, so these two ingredients. Now, how about the departure from thermal equilibrium? So as I said before, we're generating asymmetry while dark matter is annihilating. But while it's generating this asymmetry, there are washout processes that are killing off the asymmetry. And these washouts come in various forms. You can have inverse annihilations. You can have these leptons into anti-lepton scattering. There's a bunch of T-channel processes. And basically, we need to have these things freeze out during the era of rapid WIMP annihilation. The reason being that it's the annihilation of the dark matter that's generating the asymmetry. And so if this washout happens after dark matter is frozen out, then there's no more annihilation going on. And so you can't get any asymmetry. So you need some cartoon timeline like this, where you have, here's the time at which dark matter annihilation starts, and there's some interval over which it's annihilating, and then at a certain time it freezes out. So what we need to have is washout processes also be active in this period, but have them shut off. And this is basically going to be dictated by the coupling of the lepton to the scalar and also by what the mass of this psi particle is. The reason being that if psi is somewhat heavy and it's going to have a suppressed abundance, then you can have a suppressed washout during this period. Now, if we want to be more precise about this, we actually have to compute the evolution of all of these different quantities. So I'll introduce a little bit of a few results that tell us, you know, how we should expect these abundances to go, and then how we can solve the equations, at least schematically. And then I'll show you some full numerical results. So in order to talk about all this, we're going to define some dimensionless variables. So the first one is we're going to exchange the temperature T for some inverse temperature Z. Essentially, it's a way of normalizing the temperature to the mass of the dark matter particle. And this is the relevant quantity determining freeze out, because when the temperature gets much below the dark matter mass, you're going to have everything freeze out. Okay. And it's such that at later times, this Z is large because temperature decreases. So it proceeds in a normal chronological way as normal time. So you can think of it as a time variable. And then we also define the number of density per co-moving volume. And the reason why we do this is because the universe is expanding while all of this is going on. And we want to see if these abundances are changing, how much of it is changing due to the actual rates of interaction that are going on. We don't care about just dilution because of expansion. We automatically have that. So we put this in to mob that out. And so how do these particles scale while they're in equilibrium, first of all? So they start in equilibrium and follow some equilibrium distribution. When they're relativistic, so when the temperature is much, much larger than the mass of these particles, then their distributions are just constant. Right? The only change in their number density is due to the expansion of the universe. And this is just because forward and backward rates are the same. However, when they're non-relativistic, then you end up with this exponential Boltzmann suppression of the equilibrium distribution. And this is precisely the result that inverse processes shut down when you're well below the temperature is well below the mass of the particle. So as these things become quite non-relativistic, then we want dark matter and the lepton asymmetry to go out of equilibrium in order to satisfy the condition. And this will determine what the final dark matter relic abundance is. This is determined by freeze out, and what the Baryon asymmetry we'll get is. So we do this by solving the Boltzmann equations. And the Boltzmann equations relate the changes in the number densities of a particular species of particle to their scattering rate. So this is the rate of particle A scattering off of a different particle going into C and D. Okay? And it's going to be proportional to the phase space density of this particle. So that if it's suppressed, the scattering rate is going to be suppressed, et cetera. So let's figure out what the evolution of both of these terms are. We care about the dark matter relic density and the lepton asymmetry. So the evolution of the dark matter is going to be proportional to its annihilation cross-section and this phase space integral. We want the equation to drive the dark matter distribution to its equilibrium value when scattering is fast, okay? Because that's by definition what the equilibrium value is. And finally, we want this equation to be proportional to the square of the dark matter distribution, because we have dark matter scattering off of itself. And so we expect to have two factors from this phase-based turn on. And this allows us to schematically, yeah.
So I guess that actually goes back to Peter's question. So in your apps, you're not considering
how we're talking about it. Yeah, that's right. But the effects are small at these temperatures. Yeah. So these are just classical distributions.
You're sure that back
I think so, yeah. Just for a thermal bath. Yeah. These temperatures. At least according, yeah. So this allows us to at least schematically write down what the form of the dark matter evolution equation is going to be if we want to satisfy all of these properties. So we find that the change in the dark matter distribution is, again, proportional to its annihilation cross-section times this factor, which tries to drive it to its equilibrium value. And what's interesting about this equation is that when the asymmetry is small, like the observed asymmetry is, it's about 10 to the minus 10, there's not really any back reaction in the dark matter evolution equation. This gives you exactly the same evolution equation as you have for a WIMP, plus some terms that are suppressed by 10 orders of magnitude relative to this. So that's completely negligible. And so the results that we have for WIMP dark matter hold exactly in this case. So in particular, we have that the dark matter relic abundance is inversely proportional to its annihilation cross-section. And we see this plot of how the dark matter number density changes with time. So this is its equilibrium distribution. It's trying to stick close to it. But at a certain point, the scattering can't keep up with it anymore, and it freezes out, just flattens. Okay? And what we want is for our asymmetry to be generated sort of in this region here, where we have very rapid annihilation. Because once we're at this flat region, we don't get any annihilation anymore. And this allows us to explicitly see how the out-of-equilibrium condition and the Sakharov conditions is satisfied. So when this field is non-relativistic, its number density is changing. It's changing like an exponential. And if it tracks its equilibrium distribution, then the change in its number density has to be the same, basically, as its change in its equilibrium number density. That's just what it means to follow its equilibrium distribution. However, if we look at the form of the equation, which I've hopefully removed from this slide, if dark matter is actually in equilibrium, then this thing is zero. Okay? So you can't have dark matter exactly be in equilibrium during this time period. Otherwise, it can't follow the the evolution of its equilibrium distribution. So the point is that just the fact that the universe is expanding and you have net dark matter annihilation implies a deviation from thermal equilibrium. And in particular, if we sort of integrate this deviation from equilibrium, what we find is that what tells us how much equilibrium is being violated is how much the dark matter number density is changing. And that if we were perfectly in equilibrium, then this you wouldn't have any change in the properties of anything. So sometimes people get hung up on they want a big departure from thermal equilibrium, meaning they want these terms of dark matter number density minus equilibrium number density to be small. But in some sense, that's the wrong way of thinking about it. Really, the right way of thinking about it is what's just the change in the number of density of this thing over a period of time tells me how much equilibrium is being violated. So even if at each particular point in time it's only a small contribution, you actually get some very large deviation from equilibrium. And this is enough to generate a Baran asymmetry. So the point is that it's not freeze out that's taken away from equilibrium. There is a large departure from thermal equilibrium here, but from the perspective of generating asymmetry, what you need is net dark matter annihilation. Because each time you have dark matter annihilation, you're generating some amount of asymmetry. And so you don't actually need dark matter to be, its number density to be very far out of equilibrium, just because the fact that it's annihilating means that its number density is changing, and the asymmetry that you generate in this time is going to be basically the change in its number density.
So the distinction is that the freeze-out annihilation stops.
That's right. So there's a large deviation of the dark matter distribution from equilibrium. And here, you can't even see it, but it's still big enough in order to generate.
I think actually the same happens in thermal epigenesis. You can start off with the thermal abundance of your rising in neutrinos and still get an asymmetry because it's just you're integrating over time.
That's right. So there's a big deal made sometimes where they have the distribution of the right-hand neutrinos and they look for some little bump of the change in equilibrium. But often that bump can be really small. But if you're integrating over a long time, then you get. I mean, just the fact that its number density is changing implies a departure from the thermal equilibrium.
Sorry, so then this is actually dominated near Z1.
That's right.
That helps a lot with the whole stone relative to having it being dominated at 30.
That's right. I mean, if there were no washout, it would be, as soon as it starts annihilating, it's going to give the dominant contribution.
Right.
But remember that we also have these other interactions we have to worry about. So
That's right.
And we'll show explicitly how this comes about. But yes, that's exactly right. Okay, so if we look at the evolution of lepton asymmetry, then we have two important terms. The first term is we're generating an asymmetry through dark matter annihilation, and then we're going to have a depletion of the asymmetry by these washout terms. And there's going to be some balance between those two terms. So we get a Boltzmann equation that looks like the efficiency of generating an asymmetry per annihilation times the WIMP annihilation rate. And then we're going to have this washout rate, and it's going to be times what the asymmetry is, because that's what the washout is sensitive to. So this term is just going to be the derivative of dark matter with respect to time. And this washout rate is going to be proportional to the washout cross-section times the number density of the lepton field times the number density of the psi field. So this just comes from the Boltzmann equation where we're multiplying by these two phase space densities. Okay. So now, how do we figure out how much asymmetry we have at a particular point in time? Well, at early times, the washout rate is going to be very rapid. And so this turns into just a normal rates problem. You're pouring water into a bucket, and there's a hole at the bottom of the bucket that's shedding water. Okay? That's exactly what's happening to the asymmetry. You have some term that's sourcing the asymmetry, and then you have some other term that's proportional to the amount that you have that's trying to eliminate it. So you can define some sort of instantaneous steady state solution that tells us at any given time how much we expect to have. And it's exactly where these rates balance. So the asymmetry that you get at any particular point is basically the rate of generation divided by the rate of washout. So it's going to be proportional to this expression here. And the key point is that this dark matter distribution is falling exponentially fast. So if this washout stays in equilibrium, then you might start out with a sizable asymmetry, but it's going to get damped to a very, very small number very quickly. Okay, so this shows us that while washout is rapid, we get something that's too small for the observed error in asymmetry. Okay, so just like in the cartoon that I had, we need to have washout go out of equilibrium. And in the limit where that happens rapidly, all we have to do basically is strike out this term in our equation. And what we're left with, approximately, is just this, where the rate of change of the lepton asymmetry is proportional to the dark matter annihilation rate. This is something that hopefully everyone can integrate. This is just going to be the efficiency of generating it times the change in the dark matter number density between. So if I define Z naught as the point at which washout freezes out, it's just the change in the number density of dark matter. And this is sort of what I was getting at when I said that if you integrate it over a period of time, it's really the change in dark matter number that's telling you what your departure from thermal equilibrium is. So if washout freezes out well before WIMP freeze out, so on this log plot, if washout's freezing out, here, so this is while the dark matter abundance is well above what its final abundance is going to be, then what you find is that this term is subdominant to this one. And basically, the amount of lepton asymmetry you get is sensitive to the amount of dark matter you have at the time that washout shuts off. Okay? So it's dominant sort of right after this process happens. So this allows us to make some kind of comment about where we expect washout to freeze out. And then this will be relevant in ensuring that we get a sufficiently large asymmetry. So if we want our lepton asymmetry to be about 10 to the minus 10, and we know that this fraction has to be less than 1, then we can immediately read off at what point washout has to freeze out before. Otherwise, you just get too small of an asymmetry to account for the bare iron asymmetry. So this is just as simple as drawing a straight line across from 10 to the minus 10. We see that washout has to happen around z equals 20, so when you're about 20 times below the mass of the dark matter particle in temperature. So the washout rate is proportional to the cross-section times these number densities. And so there are, in some sense, two ways that you can have things that can trigger washout freeze out. So the first one is if this psi is heavy, in which case this thing is going to be exponentially suppressed. Okay? And that basically means that in order to eliminate the lepton asymmetry, you need to scatter off of one of these particles. But if they're hard to find, then the washout rate can be small. And then the second possibility is just that the annihilation cross-section is much bigger than the washout cross-section, such that washout freezes out first. And this implies some hierarchy of couplings. But remember that the efficiency of generating asymmetry also went like the fourth power of the coupling. So if you make the lepton number violating coupling really small, then you're also reducing the amount of asymmetry you get. So it's really this first one is going to be the dominant factor in determining when washout freezes out. So to show a cartoon of how these things are happening as a function of time, I've shown on this red plot how the dark matter number density is changing. So this just follows the same curve that we had before. In the blue, we have washout freezing out before the WIMPs do. And so we see that washout is freezing out sort of in this region, and there's an exponential turn on. And the asymmetry is dominantly determined by sort of this point, how much dark matter we have when washout is actually turning off. Of course, it's not happening suddenly like in our approximation, but it's close enough that it basically gives you the same answer to within an order of magnitude. In the other case, however, if you have strong washout such that washout remains in effect until after dark matter is finished annihilating, then what you get is this sort of, as we saw before, you have some large asymmetry that gets damped away, and then it just flattens out. And this is some few orders of magnitude too small for what the observed quantity is. So to recap what we've seen, we can get baryogenesis through dark matter annihilation if it's happening through lepton number violating couplings and if they're non-zero CP phases. But we need washout to freeze out while WIMP annihilation is still going on. And this implies that you need to have somewhat heavy field psi. And it's interesting that the dark matter is described by its equilibrium distribution during its whole time. So it actually makes it quite easy to see intuitively when things have to happen in order to get the right answer. So you don't need the dark matter distribution to be out of equilibrium. You just need really the washout to be out of equilibrium. All right, so as I had said earlier, this is really just attaching some initial fields onto your decay diagram. So you could ask, well, we also have to worry about what's happening to the decay of this field, right? Otherwise, then you, if the asymmetry from this thing is bigger than the asymmetry from that thing, then you're back in the regime of being decay dominated. And so we can't really say the dark matter annihilation is doing any of these things. So we want to compare these two terms. So to do so, we just extend the intuitive result that we had before and say that, well, before any dark matter that was left over after washout stopped sort of efficiently converted into an asymmetry through annihilation, now if we just take our formula and add on a corresponding term that says, well, when washout turns off, all of the decays are also going to fairly efficiently create an asymmetry. And so this is going to... What do you mean? That's right, that's right. So, but in solving the Boltzmann equations, you always subtract off the real intermediate states so that you can separately account for both of these things. But yes, that's right. So in order to have a dominant contribution from annihilation, what we basically need is that for there to be more dark matter hanging around at the time that washout stops than these scalars. Right? So if there are more of them, then and they're given by their thermal distributions, then basically the requirement is that the dark matter mass has to be smaller than the scalar mass. Now, it works equally well if the mass of the dark matter is heavier than the scalar, but then you're in an entirely different limit, and a lot of the things that we talk about just don't really matter, because you get exactly what you would have expected if you had just done it with decays. Okay, so... So let's see numerically what we're going to end up with. We have to derive some result that quantifies the amount of CP violation.
Yes. Why can't you just turn off the decay by making S a little lighter than the
same? So if you do that, then it's going to go through the three-body decay. So for example, this psi isn't a stable particle, so it can just...
Oh, to NH?
Yeah. Yeah, you can make that super long-lived, but in some sense that makes it worse, right? In that.
Oh, you're saying S will under-less later on.
That's right. That's right. So there will be some extra factors because you're going through a three-body process rather than a two. So, but remember that when you're doing the CP violation, you put these particles on shell, so you're reducing some of the strength of the loop factors, so you'd still get a large contribution. Okay. And the other thing to point out is that at this late time, the couplings have to be extremely small in order for S to decay out of equilibrium, because this is all happening at the TeV scale, so the coupling has to be of order 10 to the minus 7. So even incorporating phase suppression from three-body decays and whatnot, I mean, you need to crank down some coupling somewhere. Okay. So we have, where was I? Okay, so we have this fractional asymmetry that's the difference in the rate of annihilation to leptons into annihilation to antileptons. And there are lots of free parameters in this game, so what we're going to do is make some assumptions just in order to simplify the analysis so that we can actually make some kinds of comparisons. So we're basically going to assume only one flavor of lepton is relevant for doing this, so we don't have to worry about flavor issues, and you know, asymmetries being converted from one flavor to another. We're going to assume that we're going to predominantly annihilate through one scalar, so that only one set of couplings and that scalar mass is most important. And we're going to assume that the phases are large in these new couplings. So if we make these assumptions, then doing the loop calculation, we end up with this for our parameter epsilon. Just like before, it's proportional to the fourth power of these Yukawa couplings, the imaginary part of them. The mass suppression here, because of the fact that you need both of these scalars to exist in order to give you non-zero CP violation, is a little bit worse because these are scalar propagators, so it's going to go like the square of one over the square of the other. And then we include in here some function of m psi over twice the x mass, which accounts for the fact that in order to go on shell, the mass of two of these guys has to be bigger than the mass of one of the psi's in order for this to even be kinematically allowed. And so this takes into account all the finite mass effects for that phase space closing off as psi becomes heavy. So if we want this to scatter dominantly through the first scalar, you can make some arbitrary choice about what the ratio of these annihilation, washout cross-sections have to be. And what this does is it allows you to express this CP violating parameter solely in terms of parameters connecting the first scalar and the first generation of lepton. So what we're saying is that all of these other parameters, the masses, the couplings, only contribute in the loop to what this epsilon is. And in some sense, it makes more sense to just treat epsilon as the free parameter. And we say, OK, there's some constraint on how big it can be. So we'll just scan over the parameter space that gets it that big so that we avoid the redundancy due to all of these other couplings. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to treat epsilon as a free parameter, and we're going to subject it to this bound when we're doing our numerical scans. So to get the numerical results, in spite of all of this, we still actually have a lot of free parameters. We have the dark matter mass. We have the mass of this new doublet. We have the mass of the scalar. And we have these two Yukawa couplings. And finally, the size of CP violation. So to get some sense of over what masses this can work, what we're going to do is say we are going to allow these couplings to take on any perturbative value and see sort of what range of masses this can even work for. Okay? So for we're not holding these couplings fixed necessarily. We're sort of seeing, can we find the masses for which this works at all? And so if we do that, we end up with a parameter space that looks like this. And this is sort of the worst looking part, which is because of the fact that we needed to have this M psi to be heavy enough to suppress the washout. Okay? So you're sort of squeezed in one direction. You want it to be heavy so that it's around the dark matter mass in order to give you a large enough asymmetry. But if its mass gets too big, then all of a sudden this isn't kinematically allowed anymore. And so you find that this particle has to lie within a factor of one or two of the dark matter mass in order to get this to work. So this is sort of the degree of tuning that you need in order to get the model to work. But beyond that, the couplings themselves take quite natural values. And also worth pointing out in this plot is precisely this question of the dark matter annihilating before the sphalerons turn off. So what we did was we took the standard model Higgs phase transition, and we computed the baryon asymmetry at that point. So we said, OK, at the phase transition, just cut off the transfer of lepton number to baryon number. That's a little bit pessimistic, because usually the sphalerons will continue on for a little bit afterwards. And then say, what regions do you still get a big enough asymmetry? And so this region below the dashed line is where the asymmetry in the baryons becomes too small, because you're just not transferring enough of it. So this is exactly around the line of one, a little bit below 1 TeV that you need for your dark matter mass. OK, so now how about what kinds of couplings do we need? We're going to choose points in the middle of the parameter space to see what we get. So we're still going to have a 5 TeV scalar. And so what we show here are contours of dark matter relic density and of baryon asymmetry. And the dark matter relic density that we observe is the red one, and the baryon asymmetry we observe is the red one. And what this shows is how these couplings vary. What do we expect? And so we find that it's in the region where these couplings are both order one and are of similar orders of magnitude that these sort of order of magnitude bands intersect one another. And so we naturally get with these order one couplings about what the right dark matter relic density and baryon asymmetry are, subject to this condition that this psi mass be within this band. So once you've done that, you don't really have to tune the couplings. You automatically get this. But really, the condition is on the psi mass. So what have we done with this? We constructed some concrete model that allowed us to explore when this kind of scenario could work. We found that we need to have all the masses to be order TeV for leptogenesis and couplings to be order 1, and that the asymmetry is sufficiently large in the region where these two masses are comparable. But the major limitation on this scenario is that the leptogenesis scale had to be higher than the electroweak scale. So we're interested.
Can you go back to the plots for a second?
Yes.
So the left one, I mean, this is fairly determinative, right? Like the lambda I, sorry.
That's right. So the lambda L has to be about 5, so it's quite big.
I mean, have you looked at like whether there's lambda poles near the TV scale? scale in these theories?
Yeah, so in these theories, you only get sort of maybe two orders of magnitude up, two orders of magnitude up. So what my statement to that would be that I think that no one would argue that this is a complete theory.
Right.
And so the hope is that there would be other things that would change the running at higher scales, or that would explain why you have these big.
But I mean, something like, right, completing a problem coupling is pretty hard, unless you're really making something coupling.
Yeah. Yeah, so you need to have quite big couplings in order to make it work. Okay. So now for when you're annihilating the quarks. So another point that I would make towards that is that I think that these results are a little bit skewed to the pessimistic because we're making these assumptions about you have some hierarchy between the second scalar mass being heavier than the first one. So the problem is that if you make it lower, then your results become very sensitive to what that mass is, because you have to worry about resonances and things. So I think that you could improve it a little bit so that you would say, okay, well, we're sort of on the upper end of the range that we might consider plausible, but that sort of doing a full analysis of everything would help. And similarly, you would boost your asymmetry by a factor of, if you had annihilating into multiple flavors of leptons, you could boost your asymmetry.
Right. Yeah, and then I guess the other related question is whether you can make
kind
of the extra version of it that doesn't run into problems. Some little flavor violating generalization of this so that you don't have the flavor problems with this sector or its equation.
That's right. So, I mean, we had assumed that there was, so just like in the charged electron sector, we assumed there was an approximate U1 cubed symmetry. So that whatever, it aligns with the flavor breaking in the charged electron sector, and then you avoid problems. But making that consistent with neutrino masses is challenging. It's less tricky in the quark case because you can have explicit MFD. So okay. So the quark model, I'm not going to go into too much detail because the one that we wrote down is similar to the leptogenesis, except now we're going to choose to annihilate to the up quark, say, and this psi is now going to be a color triplet in order to have gauge invariance of this operator. So just like before, you have to worry about what happens to this asymmetry. And so, for example, you can have psi decaying through some coupling into two down quarks plus a singlet. So this is very easily embedded in supersymmetric theories where this is where you have some sort of quark-like coupling here, and then this is a UDD type interaction. Okay. But this is going to have implications for the constraints on psi. So we're no longer subject to constraints from the Sphalerons decoupling, but we now have some new color charged state, and this is going to have collider bounds acting on it. So. Okay, so we have a similar type of Lagrangian, and we have similar interactions. Basically, the only thing that's changed are the gauge charges of these objects. And so we can do a similar scan. We modify the Boltzmann equations to account for all the group theory factors and everything. So once again, we have these six parameters. Now, this particle is colored, and so there are stronger, more stringent collider bounds on it. So in particular, with the particular decay mode I'd chosen, this particle went into two down quarks plus a singlet. And that, if you pre-produce it at a collider, gives you a four jets plus missing energy signal. So the bounds on this thing are going to be similar to Guino bounds. However, if you constructed some more elaborate model, then you might be able to hide this particle a little bit more. And so the lower bound on the masses for these will get shifted a little bit. The point is that if this is how light this psi guy can go, then there's some restriction on how light the dark matter mass can be and still kinematically annihilate into it.
So it also means now that you should populate psi and n fields, right? Because now you can have two quarks going.
That's right. That's right. No, because you can still write down a symmetry, Z4 symmetry, though, such that, yeah, to have psi, psi bar. Right? So you can never have, how do I put this? You never end up actually eliminating their number through those couplings. Yeah.
Are you sure about this 800 GeV number? It seems a little high.
Yeah, because you can. I mean, this thing is strongly charged, so you're just pair producing.
Right, but I mean, compared to like the level on Boolean's when the LSP is say 400 GB, is 400 GB. So unless the cross section is much bigger than for Boolean's.
Oh, but this thing is decaying into a single electron dark matter, so it's a very light LSP scenario, right?
Oh, okay, sorry. Right, that's not the X-mass, that's the M-mass.
Yeah. So you could, in principle, so this is what I mean by if you construct a more elaborate model, you can kind of digest things. Okay. But so this is sort of the stupidest thing you can write down, and so we want to see what's the most sort of leeway that we could have with this one. So we end up with similar looking things, but we can now make the scalar and the dark matter particle much lighter. We actually end up getting more parameter space in this region, and the reason for that is that because sphalerons are decoupled while dark matter is annihilating, then you actually have the asymmetry distributed among fewer fields. And so you actually end up with a larger concentration of asymmetry in quarks. So you can actually end up getting more. And then similarly here, it's not as bad now that you have a coupling is about 2 for the baryon number 1 and point something for the dark matter.
You have to be here at 30 to 10, right? If you look at 0.3, lambda x 0.3,
30. OK, I guess you're right. Well, 0.2.
I mean, your lambda x is better, but lambda b doesn't better or worse.
It's not going to be worse. I mean, this is definitely below 15, so
yeah,
this is 13.
If you look at the x, right, it's like 0.22 12.
Sorry, so this is lambda b over lambda x. So this is.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to show what's the relationship between these couplings. So it's going to be like 2 or 3. And part of the reason why this helps is that you have just larger annihilation cross sections, so you're going to collate stuff. You have collated stuff. So this is a little bit better. Okay, now I'll, because I think I'm running out of time, just quickly going through what are some ways that you could observe this. So the phenomenology is going to be model dependent. Part of the problem is that the only thing that baryogenesis cares about is what the dark matter is actually annihilating to. But then how those things in turn decay and interact with standard model fields is not specified by the mechanism. The only requirement in all of this is that the fields, the final product fields be held in thermal equilibrium. So for example, we had this colored psi particle in the quark case that decayed to 2 jets plus a singlet, but you could in principle have other stuff going on all entirely in that sector. And that will change how it appears at colliders. So, in both of the scenarios, we considered this psi decayed into a gauge singlet, and so you get signatures with missing energy. So Suzy searches would apply. But again, you could conceive of some theory where somehow I don't know. We haven't really been able to come up with anything where you can actually get a sort of non-singlet final state if you're pair producing them. So in the leptogenesis scenario, you can pair produce these doublets, and they decay to Higgses plus these neutral guys. The Chargino searches at LEP are the strongest constraint on these things. They're constrained to be about 100 GeV, but this is much, much lighter than what we needed to make the model work. And you could, in principle, improve these constraints. I mean, I'm interested in thinking about electro reproduction and determining this kind of topology anyway, independently of this baryogenesis scenario. So you might be able to have some targeted searches where you're looking for these Higgses, you use B tagging, try to reconstruct the Higgs mass. And this is something that we're thinking about at the moment. But even in the most optimistic scenario, this probably wouldn't get up to the scale you need in order to be the charged particle for baryogenesis. But because it couples to leptons, you could, in principle, if you have a lepton collider, see something. Annihilation of quarks is a little bit more straightforward. You have this 4 jet plus missing energy final state. And so the current LHC bound excludes the scenario below 800 GeV. So if you really believe that this is how things are going, then the LHC should test up to a few TeV at 100 inverse temperature barns. And that should really clear out much of the parameter space for dark matter that we should be able to see. So the other thing to think about is indirect detection, because this is symmetric dark matter. And so in both of these scenarios, do we have annihilations to quarks in the final state? And so the best prospect for doing these are anti-deuteron searches. The reason being that astrophysical backgrounds for low-energy deuterons are typically much, much smaller than astrophysical backgrounds for antiprotons or anything else. And ultimately, this is connected to the fact that anti-deuterons have a very small binding energy. And so it's hard to produce them without blowing them apart. So this has been explored in a few papers. Now, the lepton case, you don't really get very much reach here. And the reason is that you're annihilating into Higgs and Ws. So these are color singlet objects that are boosted, and then they decay, and they patternize in the frame of the boosted object. The upshot of that is that, similar to the astrophysical observables or events that are going on, it's very hard to produce anti-deuteron at low energies in the Earth frame. Brunellian into quarks, however, then these two things annihilate into some colored fields, which are all color connected, because they're all coming from the same singlet. So you're hadronizing in the rest frame of dark matter annihilation, which is roughly the rest frame that we observe things. And so you can actually populate the low energy anti-deuteron spectrum. So just because you have these color connections breaking in the rest frame, you can have several orders of magnitude more low energy deuterons than you get in this scenario. And so the exclusion reach is approaching the TeV scale with the AMS and GAPS satellites. So that's something to look out for. And because this is the scenario that the colliders are also saying the most about, then you might have some hope of doing some kind of crossover and saying, well, if you see some anomaly in both, then maybe there's some connection between them. And maybe if you look more carefully at the spectrum, if you know what masses you're looking at, you can look at any protons and see what's going on. So to conclude, we suggested this idea of wimpy baryogenesis, where we have baryogenesis happening at the weak scale from dark matter annihilation. And if we have this relationship between the masses, then you can get the correct relic density and baryon asymmetry with TeV scale masses and order one couplings, although the couplings in some scenarios do get a little bit big. This is at the weak scale, and so there could be some implications for experiments. We're in the process of seeing whether tweaking this, perturbing this original model can have more spectacular signals or ways that we can evade these lower bounds that we've been talking about. This is sort of an interesting new idea. So, thank you.
So given the time and the fact that we already asked many questions, maybe we should let whoever wants to just leave and then whoever wants to sit and ask more questions.
Sorry about the delay initially.
No, it's okay, but it's not your fault. So maybe just thank the speaker once again and then ask for the